On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we discuss the latest news, discuss Triple HC's upcoming web interface transition, review new CDC guidance on respiratory illness, discuss how to avoid practitioners that don't meet your quality expectations, and in our focus segment, we talk about the National Practitioner Data Bank with a lawyer from Dinsmore.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, the longest-running podcast specifically focused on the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. We would like to thank our sponsor, Surgical Information Systems, providing cutting-edge information solutions for surgery providers. Trivalence offers a comprehensive next-generation ASC solution that optimizes payment and supply chain performance, enabling actionable data insights. MedServe, which is the only digital narcotic cabinet specifically designed and priced for surgery centers, helping standardize processes and compliance, eliminate paper logs, and prevent drug diversion. And Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, the nation's leading regulatory and accreditation compliance resource for ambulatory surgery centers. For more information about our sponsors, visit our website at ascpodcast.com.
Welcome to episode 214 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for March 3rd, 2024. We're recording from our studios in Spencerport, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, co-host of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey and Operations Manager for Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. We'd like to remind our listeners that the ASC regulatory environment is a rapidly evolving landscape, and the material presented in this episode is based on the most current information available as of the date of recording. As such, it is important to recognize that this information may be subject to change, and we advise all ASCs to stay up to date with the latest regulations and guidelines issued by their relevant regulatory bodies. And joining me today is John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and one of the most respected experts in the ambulatory surgery industry. With over 30 years of experience, Mr. Gailey has authored over 10 books on the ASC industry, and he is a sought-after speaker on regulatory accreditation and finance issues.
So this is a busy time, though. I feel like we say that every single episode. we actually were just about to record a special episode about pharmacy with one of our new sponsors. And 1 minute before the episode was supposed to be recorded, unfortunately, I had to be called away from a family emergency. Everything's all right. But unfortunately, now Sue and I were kind of scrambling here to get a new episode out because we were kind of planning on that. So it is very busy. I'm heading down to Pennsylvania as soon as we finish recording this. I'm doing another survey this week. I've been trying to pack all the surveys in before the new software comes out.
Because yes, can't blame you.
Yeah, I'm getting old, and changing, you know, completely to a completely new system is a little daunting for me. And what was it? 2 weeks ago, I was in Connecticut for a wonderful survey. I really enjoy doing these surveys, especially when the centers are great and the people are very cooperative and interested in learning. Mm-hmm. And every time I do a survey, I learn something myself. So, and we're very busy with. We actually have three centers under construction or in the process of opening right now, and I believe we still have another. I think two or three in the wings coming up. So it has been a very, very busy time, not the least of which is because we have babies, Sue, don't we?
Yes, we do.
We have three.
We have one new baby.
Yeah.
We've got one that I can't believe is not here yet. We're waiting.
If you see a ding in the middle of the episode here, it's probably him.
Any moment, a couple days past due date, that's Alex, one of our relatives and director of operations. And then John's daughter is due not until April, but so, you know, it's like every 2 months.
Right.
We're getting a new baby. We planned it well. We can just keep passing clothes down, right? And my daughter's baby is about 2.5 months old.
I know. It's hard to believe. Yeah. And John, of course, who's a regular on the podcast, she's coming up, as you said, in April. And she's our startup specialist. So that's going to be quite a challenge. So three employees out of 25 employees. That's more than a 10% rate. But we're looking forward to the children, but it's going to be kind of hectic for the rest of us as we scramble to make sure that we service all of our clients appropriately. And Sue, it's been a very quiet. I know you asked me to kind of check on the regulatory front. Mm-hmm. You do the regular news. I tend to look at this regulatory stuff, and it's been kind of boring. By the way, I'm not complaining, but it's kind of boring from the CMS regulatory standpoint. Really nothing out there right now. We're still waiting for revised guidance on the interpretive guidelines. You might remember that in 2023, CMS issued just a relatively minor revision to the interpretive guidelines that removed the requirement or removed the language with regard to the requirement for a COVID vaccine. So that's been done. Sue is working on some of the writing for the upcoming revision to our survey guide. Last time we revised it was in 2020, so there will be a 2024 version, hopefully out in the next couple months. And next week is our Business Office Managers Boot Camp, if you're listening to this the week before that boot camp, and it's going to be same format as our other popular boot camps. It's 4 days of virtual training, followed with a recording of it for people to follow up on afterwards, as well as ongoing mentoring. Usually the mentoring takes the form of ongoing or voluntary or optional weekly drop-in sessions on Saturday mornings. And our new premium access program is starting to gain steam. We really haven't been advertising this much, Sue, but we're kind of surprised at how popular it's been so far. And we haven't even really rolled it out. Still at an introductory price right now of about $2,800. Which provides unlimited access to most of our educational programs, including, of course, our very popular administrators and director of nursing boot camps. The price for this program is less than the price of taking both the administrator and director of nursing boot camps, and of course, those are unlimited. So it also includes private consultations and, of course, access to our weekly drop-in sessions. So for more information about that access program, it's a really good option for centers that probably don't need a full-time consultant like what we offer at Amateur Healthcare Strategies, but wants access to a lot of our educational programs, not just for leaders, but also for, you know, like our infection control coordinators, et cetera. And we're going to be introducing quite a number of new programs throughout the year. We have we're working on a quality improvement program, a survey preparedness program, and of course our life safety program, which has been in the works for quite a while. We think it's going to be in the fall right now.
And of course, if you have a lot of turnover, this is great to prepare new people. And even if you don't, sometimes we have people that even go to the same boot camp more than once, because there's always something new you can learn. There's just so much information, and you have the ability to ask questions.
One of our administrators takes the course every year, as a matter of fact.
Of course, and it's not that it's somebody that doesn't get it, so they have to keep – it's that they are really very experienced, and so they really get the nuances, and little things come up, and they're able to explore, you know, some questions that they might have.
Yeah, and I'm sure he could actually teach part of it now, but it's just something that's become a regular habit. And of course, he's got a long commute, so he tends to listen to it in the car. And of course, don't forget about our patron program that allows you access to our drop-in sessions and a large database of information. That's a very popular program. We have over 250 patrons. I think it's actually closer to 300 right now. So let's talk about some of our recent news. Go ahead, Sue.
Hey, so I wanted to just have a quick discussion of the CDC change in their guidance. Now, really important to note that this is only for the general public. It is not for healthcare facilities. So it looks like they're starting to group COVID in with other respiratory illnesses such as flu and RSV. It's just kind of a general respiratory illness guideline right now. So.
And Sue, while you're on that subject, let's just kind of remind people that you should be moving away from specific policies and protocols that address COVID. You really should. The term that we're now using, and I encourage you to use too in your centers, is emerging communicable diseases, and of course, respiratory diseases in particular is what you're talking about.
I think so, because even when we say emerging respiratory illnesses, that might be something
too restrictive.
But I mean, it's still is fairly new.
Right.
So that's still okay. But so in general, they just suggest or recommend staying up to date with your vaccinations, practicing good hygiene, like covering your coughs and your sneezes, washing your hands, just those general common sense things, taking steps for cleaner air, like opening your windows, gather outside when you can, use a purifier for indoors if you're able to do that. But they're saying you can return to normal activities when you've been fever-free and have improving symptoms for at least 24 hours. So that's much less restrictive than it used to be. But again, this is general public. This isn't talking about going into, you know, for surgery or healthcare workers or anything. And they encourage you to practice prevention strategies for an additional 5 days, like possibly masking or distancing, just to be aware that there are people out there that might be immune compromised, and just to, as a courtesy, to kind of try to prevent spreading it. There are more specific recommendations for higher risk groups that you can find on the CDC site. And this decision, they said, is based in part on the decreasing hospitalization and death rates from COVID-19. So they said hospital admissions for COVID have decreased in the U.S. by more than 60% since 2021. So that's good news. And even better news, the death rates have dropped by 83%. Yeah. COVID-19 now ranks as the 10th most common cause of death in the U.S., which is a drop from third place in 20 and 21. Now, the drop is partly due to improved community immunity from prior infections and vaccinations. And also, they have just better treatments, so they know how to deal with it now. So I think, you know, it's just, I think everybody can kind of breathe a sigh of relief now. It's just feeling a little less overwhelming. And I know I recently had COVID for the first time. Yeah. I do have my vaccinations, but, you know, it wasn't even like the worst cold I'd ever had.
Right.
So, you know, I didn't feel great, but I didn't have to stay in bed or anything. And it just, I've, you know, admittedly been kind of concerned about it.
Yeah.
And really worried. So it's kind of like a relief. And again, not to take it lightly, but just, I thought this was good news.
And we should point out that those of you that listened to our last episode, she was sick with COVID at the time. We weren't absolutely sure when we were actually doing the recording that she had COVID, but so again.
And I did, and John tested negative.
Right.
And he's had it in the past, so probably that extra boost to immunity, he didn't get it. So
I haven't had the most recent vaccine. I'm gonna have to double check. I'm losing track of things.
Yeah, no.
But I think you're 4 and I'm 3. Yeah.
Yeah, but then you also had COVID, so you've got that immunity. So.
But I think that's important for us all to realize is that I think, as you said, and well said, that we can rest a little bit easier. We're not, you know, seeing the major symptoms that we have. Even when I had COVID in 2022. I think it was in December of 2022. I didn't even know I had it.
Yeah, you weren't even that sick. And again, though, being careful, like I didn't go see my mom
until
I was very sure that I was negative. She's 90 years old. You know, I mean, just out of consideration.
Take those precautions.
But, you know.
Yeah.
And in Becker's hospital review on February 28th, just some scary news. A nurse at an Oregon hospital is being sued for wrongful death. She's accused of removing fentanyl from IV bags and replacing it with unsterile tap water. So it's bad enough that she was diverting this, but, you know, she just put regular water in there. And the officials are investigating possible allegations of medication theft that may have affected several patients. No criminal charges have been brought at this time, but there were several infections and some deaths due to infection, and they believe it was from that unsterile water being put in there. So it's just another reminder to always be very careful of your medications.
And again, that's why we really, you know, we have a new sponsor for MedServe who's going to be talking about pharmacy. That's the interview that we weren't able to do. I sometimes worry that we're talking too much about it, but it does seem to be a major issue that we're running into. I'm very worried about the, you know, possible effect. You know, I mean, this type of situation could result in pain, could be, you know, the infection control issue, could be even more serious.
People died from this.
We have to take this seriously, and I think we need to spend some more time on that.
And just saving, you know, when you have a good product that can help you to prevent diversion.
Yeah.
But keep it simple and straightforward. So I think anything we can ever do to simplify anything in our centers is always appreciated. And it is National Patient Safety Awareness Week on March 10th through the 16th. The World Health Organization defines patient safety as a healthcare discipline that emerged with the evolving complexity in healthcare systems and the resulting rise of patient harm in healthcare facilities. It aims to prevent and reduce risks, errors, and harm that occur to patients during delivery of healthcare. A cornerstone of the discipline is continuous improvement based on learning from errors and adverse events. I think it's a really good definition, especially that last line. And according to an article in ARN Outpatient Surgery magazine from February 28th, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement says medical harm results in 250,000 to 400,000 deaths per year in the U.S. Now, the theme chosen by the Center for Patient Safety this year is Safer Together, which emphasizes the importance of the entire care team, including the providers, support staff, and even the patients and their family. They're all part of that team. Some centers are putting up banners. They might have might consider having a suggestion box for safety ideas from your staff. Provide in-services, maybe have a good staff lunch or afternoon snacks or something and do some in-services, or put up educational displays or signs just to kind of bring that front of mind. And I know, without getting too specific, there, you know, we've had experiences lately with family members, and just what I hear from other people so much is that patients and families are just feeling so much less confident in their medical care and feeling almost like they need somebody there to constantly advocate for them. So I just think this is really timely, and I think that is more so especially in hospitals and larger hospitals. So I think our surgery centers already have a bit of a, you know, an edge on that because it's a little more personal, but it's just really important.
Right. We can't get complacent about it. I share with you, my mother, has been in the hospital a couple times, and it just seems like if I were not there, and she can barely hear, you know, she has very poor eyesight. And I'm just kind of shocked at how difficult it is and how much work we have to do in order to advocate for them. And Sue, that statistic is, I mean, I've known these numbers for years, 250,000 to 400,000 deaths a year. And that, you know, again, this is where I start to get passionate. That's what our whole safety program is about. That's what our whole quality improvement program is about. We're going to talk about that in another few minutes here, is, you know, to prevent these types of things. So we've got to take it seriously. I think the high quality of care that we provide in ambulatory surgery centers, we often take for granted. And we forget that, you know, the very thing that's happening in hospitals could happen with us if we become complacent and we don't keep up the high standards we've always had.
Yeah. And again, it's that continuous improvement based on learning from errors and adverse events. So it's a whole quality improvement program right there. So it's so important.
Now, for those that are HHHC accredited, remember that the new 1095 Engage program is coming up in April. At least that's the plan right now. It'll be a new computer system, a new way of HHHC and their accredited organizations will engage with each other on a regular basis. So, Sue, the old days where, you know, we get our accreditation and we don't have ongoing engagement with HHHC are going to be gone. And, you know, I think this is a good thing overall is to be able to keep up to date with what's going on, to make sure that you're always ready for a survey and, you know, use all the resources that HHHC has always had, but now it's going to be easier to access that. You know, one big part of this is that you're going to have a living profile up online, which means that you're able to adjust information. You can make much easier change notifications when you have a new administrator, director of nursing, et cetera, you know, new ownership. And based upon the procedures that you're doing, that you update within the system, your standards are going to be curated. In other words, you're not going to get an accreditation manual that you have to say, I don't have to deal with Chapter 15. Your accreditation manual is going to be specific. Your standards are going to be specific to your organization based upon the procedures that you do and that you've entered into the system. And as you add new areas, as you add new procedures or different levels of anesthesia, for example, your standards will be updated. And by the way, that's the part that I think will be very nice for surveyors. Is that our computer program, the one that we use for doing the survey, we're not going to have not applicables anymore, basically, except in, there's going to obviously going to be things that are you're probably going to check that off, but the whole chapters will not even show up in our computer program. We're going to have to get used to, and I think this is going to be the challenge for people like myself who use a pad and paper a lot while I'm on survey, is that everything really has to go into the computer right away. And you'll get a much more rapid turnaround also. also with regard to your surveys. In that regard, you're going to have a preliminary survey report very shortly after the survey is completed. And then there's also going to be this ongoing compliance verification. Now, this is indeed what already occurs with some of the other accreditation organizations. And now HHHC is going to be doing the same thing. And then there's also a modified billing structure, which is on our list here, Sue, but that's the one thing I don't know about. So I don't know how that'll work, but it'll probably be much more transparent pricing for you. Let's talk about some recent experiences. So incident reporting is something that we talk about quite a bit in our boot camps. We talk about it in our educational programs. But I'm starting to see, or I continue to see, challenges with getting especially our owners, our doctors, to understand the importance of closing the loop, the importance of incident reporting, the importance of following up on things that happen in your surgery center that you didn't anticipate. And probably the best example of that, or the best way to explain this, would be to talk about transfers. And we've been having some challenges lately with, in one particular case, one facility where the physician is really not being very cooperative with making sure that we have follow-up from the hospital mm-hmm. after a transfer. It's not just enough to determine how the patient fared after leaving the ASC, by the way. So not only do we need to get that discharge summary from the hospital, but we need to follow up to make sure that we've identified what caused the patient to have to go to the hospital. Was it something that occurred? Was the standard of care met? You know, could the situation have been prevented? Was that patient a good candidate for surgery? How was the follow-up after the procedure? Did the transfer go smoothly? Who called the patient and any other providers that were involved mm-hmm. in the care? We have to have that information in our follow-up, in our incident report. And we have to do what we call closing the loop, making sure that we've learned this really goes back to what you were talking about with risk management, Sue, is that what did we learn from that incident? If we didn't learn anything from it, then, you know, we really don't have a quality improvement program. And then, of course, you have to do peer review on the providers that were involved in this. And this is where you're often going to get pushback from the doctors because, you know, people are very litigiously concerned. They're concerned that, you know, that they're going to be sued if they say anything negative about what happened. But you have to remember that this is all protected information. So, again, let's try to avoid that pushback. And then I had an interesting question from one of our listeners related to subpar providers. It was kind of an interesting thing, wasn't it, Sue? The listener asked us, on behalf of their medical director, what to do about a low-quality provider. The medical director was not happy with a brand-new provider. He was there. He was actually the anesthesiologist involved in that procedure. And he said, you know, I don't want this person here anymore. You know, what do I do about it? So, unfortunately, I think my first answer, of course, is why did you credential them? Why did you provide them privileges in the first place? Now, I mean, that's easy for me to say because I don't know, you know, the facts behind it. But, you know, if you have an inkling that this is a provider you don't want to have in your center, don't even allow them in your center in the first place, which means that you don't even offer them an application. You always say, you know, hey, listen, I have to run any of these applications through the governing body to determine that we have, you know, space for you, that we have time for you. However you word that, you want to be what we call a closed panel, meaning that you only invite, you know, providers to your organization, that there's no open application process. So, be very careful about that. Be very careful about who you hand that application to and carefully screen those doctors during the credentialing process. Don't forget, by the way, that we did a conference, a credentialing and peer review conference in January, which very soon I'll have the on-demand version available. It's almost ready to go. I just haven't hit the button yet there. But watch our website at ASCcentral.com. We'll be talking about it on the podcast as soon as that's released. And by the way, this segues into our focus segment. Sue, during the Ohio conference, which unfortunately mm-hmm. you're not able to join me for, which was quite a number of months ago, so I apologize it's taken me this long to get this mm-hmm. out, we had an opportunity to interview Eric Plinke, and he's with a very well-known Midwestern law firm by the name of Dinsmore. And he talked about the National Practitioner Data Bank. And what was fascinating to me, Sue, I was glad that I was able to get him. is I don't think in my 30 plus years in the industry I've ever heard anybody talk, at a conference about the National Practitioner Data Bank, exclusively about it. I mean, we mention it, of course, during our conferences, but to actually have somebody, and in particular a lawyer, talk about it, I think was a great opportunity. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have this interview with Eric Plinke with Dinsmore regarding the National Practitioner Data Bank. With the rapid changes occurring in the ASC industry, the exodus of experienced ASC administrators, nurse managers, and business office managers, there is an increasing demand for quality leadership education. That's where our industry-leading boot camps come in. In 2021, we introduced our Administrator Boot Camp and the Director of Nursing Boot Camp, and in 2023, the Business Office Manager Boot Camp. These boot camps have become the industry standard for ASC leadership training, and with over 225 graduates, lead the industry in mentored virtual training.
Live virtual training for the Administrator Boot Camp occurs every January and July, and the Director of Nursing Boot Camp is October and May. Our new Business Office Manager Boot Camp will continue in the spring of 2024. There are also on-demand versions of each boot camp for those who simply can't attend the live virtual programs.
All boot camps, including the on-demand boot camps, include access to resources, membership in the ASC Central Patron Program, copies of John's latest books, access to credentialing, conditions for coverage, and other recorded training programs, and of course our regular drop-in Zoom sessions where you can ask questions and interact with other patron and boot camp members.
Our programs also include AEU credits for those that are CASC certified. Our programs are comprehensive and taught by the nation's leading ASC experts and are designed for all levels of leadership, from experienced leaders who want to enhance their skills or pass the CASC exam, or those who are new to the industry and wish to learn how to run an ASC.
For more information about our live, virtual, and on-demand programs, visit ASC Central at asc-central.com. Or you can call us at 585-594-1167 or email us at info@ascpodcast.com for more information. I'm here at the Ohio State Association meeting with Eric Plinke. He's with Dinsmore. Are there more names in the Dinsmore name?
It's Dinsmore and Scholl, actually.
Okay, yeah. Well, your name isn't up there yet.
No, you'll be up there, nor will it ever be.
That's good. I think that's a good thing. So I apologize to you because I missed your presentation because I got into a conversation with one of the other vendors here and completely missed it. So, but you and I have talked quite a bit about what you talked about. And what was the name of your presentation?
So it was NPDB and professional reporting update.
Gotcha. And it was fascinating to me, the NPDB side of it, because I don't think I've ever heard a speaker at a state association, let alone, a national association, talk about this topic. And yet every single one of our surgery centers, of course, deals with the NPD literally on a daily basis, at least when they're doing a credentialing. And so I had a whole bunch of questions and then you and I talked. And so let's just start by talking about what your presentation was focused on.
Yeah. So really, John, it was focused on, as you said, getting the word out that it's not a topic of, frequent discussion from a seminar educational standpoint, but I think from a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month, real life interactions within an ASC setting, reporting issues do come up, whether it's credentialing on the front end, reappointment, or you have an incident or occurrence in the ASC setting that triggers questions of, a professional review action or some reporting issue, or, you're just trying to do the right thing of, calling a timeout on somebody while you can do an investigation. And each of those points in the review process raises questions for data bank reporting, depending on what you're doing and how you're doing it and the circumstances under which you're doing it. And then on top of that, as I'm sure you've seen in your experience in the industry, in various states, and I submit nationally, there's a movement to be more accountable, more transparent, whether it be NPDB reporting or just professional reporting, because all the ASCs are full of professionals, whether they be physicians, nurses, CRNAs, what have you, that each of those individuals, there may be reporting requirements for the entity for misconduct separate and apart from what the data bank may require. So mm-hmm. that'll vary a bit by state, but I've done some authorship on this. It's been published. And here in Ohio, it's been a really significant point of emphasis for our regulatory board. So that's really what I was trying to tackle in this seminar. I was just being proactive and trying to move this reporting issue, whether it be data bank, NPDB reporting, or professional reporting to our state level agencies, from sort of a back of the mind to front of the mind salience, to move it up on the checklist of our issues and within your policies and procedures, and even using some of the tools that are out there for compliance training, so that, you know, when these things do happen, you're prepared to handle them according to best practice, to not be one of those centers that gets pulled into one of these nuclear threat bet the company cases from a practitioner that has had an incident at your place or others.
Well, and let's start with that. I mean, this improper credentialing, I do expert witness, as I mentioned to you before, it's becoming one of those things that's tagged on to a lot of the malpractice case. I won't say a lot of them, but it's something that plaintiff's attorneys are getting familiar with. And, you know, they just throw it in with all the other accusations that they make at the same time, which means that suddenly your credentialing process comes under scrutiny during a lawsuit. I'd much rather, you know, as a surveyor, I want to make sure that, you know, also that credentialing is done properly. So now there's two, you know, levels of threat. The surveyors are going to catch you, or, you know, you're going to end up with a lawsuit at some point. Unfortunately, it's difficult to avoid them completely in this industry. So we have to let our listeners remember, or, you know, be mindful of the fact that improper credentialing is one of the hotter topics out there right now. But beyond that, let's just start with some of the basics. What is the MPDB, and, you know, what's its main purpose out there?
Yeah, so I think the origin story is important, because if you're gonna triage and handle these issues, I think you have to have a good understanding of what the public policies are and why this law exists, where it came from, and the NPDB reporting structure. I mean, it frankly predates HIPAA. So for those of us that have been around for a while, I think it was a 1986 law, the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act, that actually stemmed from some developments at various federal agencies, but I think primarily from the VA, of some QA processes. And really it was there's five stated congressional objectives. They focus on peer review, that peer review should have an active role in facility oversight of their practitioners.
Part of the quality improvement,
But really, fundamentally, the law was there to stop at the time what was sort of state hopping or facility hopping, where a physician might have issues in one given state or at a given facility. They're reviewing that physician, and while that review is going on, there's threats of suit from the physician to the facility. You know, the practitioner goes to another state or another facility, and there's no reporting of what those issues were from the first facility.
Yeah.
At the time, one of the stated reasons was the first facility was hesitant to report because of threat of litigation.
Yeah.
And then it was also difficult in those facilities to get members of the medical staff to participate in peer review because they would be wrapped up in the litigation. So Congress addressed that sort of full sail in developing a reporting system through the data bank, which came along through the regulations, and providing some federal immunities to protect peer review. And those immunities are really significant. There's both the immunity to the report itself, but then there's also a broader immunity to the peer review action process, or the professional review action process is the term under that law. But so, you know, the data bank is, for some of us, getting a little long in the tooth, but I think the public policy aspects of it are really, you know, positive. They're there for the right reasons. And one of the other parts that I talked about today was really getting the message out there that while it's sort of a stick and a carrot and a stick approach, that, hey, you have to follow the law, but that there are benefits to it in the form of the immunity. And those immunities exist, at least under Ohio law, for the professional or entity reporting that our state requires. So, you know, you want to do the right thing in protecting your patients, protecting the public, making an issue known, And then in exchange for that, because that's not an easy decision, you know, nobody wants to be the rat, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of professions, there's sort of a culture of silence. Nobody, and then just at a personal level, nobody wants to report, you know, some of our surgery centers are small. You might be working, you might be, say, the medical director, and one of the physicians you're reviewing is somebody you trained with trained. And it's just on a personal level, it makes it very hard to discharge that reporting duty. But under the law, you know, it is the law. Yeah. There are advantages to doing it. You're not necessarily ending somebody's career. I mean, I think it's a complicated thing that needs thorough discussion and thorough consideration. But we're in a different environment now. And all you have to do is look back over the last 10 to 15 years of the regional or national media attention, whether it be, you know, Dr. Strauss here at Ohio State, Dr. Nasser, there was the physician at USC whose name is escaping me right now, but there's Dr. Death. I mean, it just seems like every couple of months or every year there's a new issue of a physician who either intentionally or unintentionally had bad outcomes or abused patients. And one of the common threads in a lot of those situations is, you know, was there proper reporting? Did people do what they were required to do at the facility level to report that? And then also at the individual level, you know, physicians may have reporting obligations. There may be reporting obligations for the nurses and what have you. Were those things done? Because, you know, if you missed one of those steps, you're going to get pulled in the media attention to one of those, quote, bad centers, end quote, that didn't do their duty. And nobody wants to be in that situation. So I think you're at risk if you're not bringing this to the forefront of your policies, to the forefront of your procedures, in just making sure that you're considering knowing what the reporting obligations are and doing a good faith effort to review the circumstances and report when needed.
So let's focus on that for a second, because I think I related to you before we spoke about a story about a situation that happened 15 years ago, you know, where I walked into a surgery center, I looked at an MPDB report, which was 70 pages long. And, you know, I asked the credentialing coordinator what she did about it, you know, and she says, I think I joke because she looked like she was 13 years old, you know, and clearly underqualified for this position. Yeah. But, you know, she had a medical director, she had an administrator, a director of nursing there who, you know, she theoretically reported to. But it was very apparent to me that they threw it in the file and left it in there. And it was 70 pages long. Yeah. Now, I'm not one to say, okay, maybe we shouldn't have granted privileges there. That's not my role.
Right.
But a physician needs to look at this and figure this out. So let's narrow in on that right now, is that, you know, what should our listeners be looking at? And start, you know, from the people that are looking at it, which are often, you know, clerical people that are looking at the credentialing, to the administrator, to the medical director. Ultimately, it's got to be decided by, you know, a medical professional, hopefully somebody in the same field. But I really want our listeners to understand how important it is that we don't just file these documents in our credential files. And maybe even if you can give some stories, you know, about how you've helped somebody along the way.
Well, I think, you know, I guess reasonable minds can differ if it's worse to not get the information to begin with or to get it and then not read it. I submit it's worse to get it and not review it, not make it part of the process, because all of your policies are telling you to do that. All your policies are, you know, the law tells you to do that.
Right.
And I think really from a triage standpoint, it starts with the policies. You know, are your policies up to date? What are your forms say? Because you're right. The NPDB reports are complicated, and for some of these providers that have had, you know, a significant claim history or some other adverse action history, they can be substantial, you know, 70 pages. And nowadays, when you render the electronic format of the NPDB into paper, and I think it becomes even longer and harder to read. And what I've developed for some clients is really, hey, here's a form where instead of handling your committee members 70 pages, you're prefacing it with, you know, here's a shortcut to what's in the NPDB, what's antiquated, what's current, and have that form created from your policies, you know, because you're going to have credentialing criteria and components that will require further scrutiny, some of which will be quality or competence related, but some of which may be administratively related. You know, some facilities may say, hey, if you've got three claims in the last 24 months, we're gonna send those cases to QA, or we're gonna do some extensive
some
review
focus
on that.
Review.
Yeah. So you need to have forms that are helping truncate or abbreviate the volume of information you're getting, whether it be original source or NPDB or other things, to focus the members in to sort of make their jobs a little bit easier so that you're not missing things. And I think that's sort of where it starts, because it's easy. You know, your committee members are often your facility leaders.
Yeah,
they're
and
leaders.
Owners.
Yeah, they're leaders because they're busy.
Right,
and they're not getting paid extra to come and sit in your 6 a.m. credentialing committee meetings. In fact, they're probably, you know, they're probably losing
and money for every minute that you're there. Yeah. That they're there.
So you have to fight against that because, like you're saying, this is fertile ground for claims. I think there's landmines in every credentialing process. I thankfully I don't have a ton of horror stories to relate about this.
That's actually good.
But I have had clients, you know, surgery center clients who, are in a rush to get somebody credentialed And I think anytime there's a rush or anytime somebody's saying, hey, I've got, you know, X number of cases and the business people are getting excited because you're going to fill your rooms and what have you. I mean, that's really the time where you have to stay the course, run your regular processes, and not expedite a committee review for something. 'Cause I did have one where a client was pushing through a practitioner, and they just happened to call me because they were also a candidate for ownership, which wasn't normal because, you know, typically somebody comes on staff and works there for a number of years and see if it's a good fit. But this physician from day one was asking about ownership, had a big volume. And I think this might have been back in the old days when we had like ordinary temporary privileges under the bylaws. And when the client read me the name, I was thinking, that name sounds a little familiar.
Not good when you're a lawyer.
And I just did some quick, digging and was able to pull up some, you know, non-flattering information that hadn't been disclosed. It wasn't that the physician had misled them or anything. It was just the way the questions were. I think he was able to plausibly deny certain things. And so just by happenstance, we were able to get, you know, a more thorough review and, you know, I think the committee still proceeded in a manner, but they proceeded in a manner differently, than if they had just, you know, rammed it through.
Yeah.
And so they were able to get some safeguards in place just to make sure that, you know, quality wise, the physician fit. But, I think it's frankly, you've hit on it. I think it's harder to do consistent quality credentialing, frankly, than it might be when an incident arises.
Yeah.
Because your systems are trained to focus on an incident, identify and correct and intervene, and everybody's, you know, sort of focused on doing that. On the credentialing side, on the front end, you know, that's where the landmines are. And I think it's harder to detect those. But I do think just being thorough and reviewing your policies and your criteria to make sure it's focused on the issues that can help you identify the landmines before you step on them. I think that's been my experience of what I've helped clients do.
And what strikes me too, that, you know, as a surveyor, we have, you know, accreditation standards and we have regulations and interpretive guidelines that focus on risk management. And then we have the same thing for credentialing. By the way, you can't see me, but I'm using my hands as I'm just showing the two sides here. But the two of them are like risk management starts with making sure you don't bring doctors on board in the first place that are likely to cause a problem.
Yeah.
And it just, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, man, you know, even when I do education on risk management, I'm starting at the wrong point.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're focusing on those incidents that maybe wouldn't have even occurred if somebody had vetted that patient, that doctor right from the very beginning. Yeah. And we're seeing that, unfortunately, you know, because it is easier. I mean, you know, surgery centers are you know, mostly money-making ventures, unlike hospitals. Hospitals are more likely to be very careful about that, unfortunately, than a surgery center will, especially when, you know, when there's a possibility of somebody bringing a whole bunch of cases to this organization. So, you know, we've got to be much more careful about assuring that, you know, that doctor who really wants, like you said, you know, the fact that they might want to have their privileges like tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Might be a warning sign that there might be some reason that they're going, you know, from a hospital who is saying, hey, I really don't want you here, or never, you know, reported anything to MPDB and just got rid of a bad actor, you know, that maybe didn't have serious problems, but, you know, had indications that there was going to be a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think your board, you know, your board training comes into play here. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, you know, that committee is reporting up to the board, and the board has to bless things. So you need to make sure that in your review processes at the board level, you know, you're 100% confident that your credentialing committee, you know, did its job.
Yeah.
And you know, that shouldn't be something that's on the, like, the consent agenda. That should be a meaningful, you know, substantive review process, because, you know, you have fiduciary duty issues. You have other legal obligations as a board member. That create risk for you, and so I think it's sort of an up the chain vertical consideration here, that, you know, at multiple levels you can have policies and procedures and in effect that can reduce this risk. As you note, that's what you're talking about, is the management of the risk. We often think of it as, well, you manage the risk after it arises. Yeah. Well, the risk is there from the front end, and you need to manage it there too.
Yeah. You brought up something totally a little bit off topic here, but you mentioned consent agendas.
Uh-huh.
I've served on a lot of boards, you know, nonprofits over the years too, and I dislike consent agendas. I really dislike them in surgery centers, because it's a good way to kind of whitewash some of these things. And if you read the interpretive guidelines, that I'm sure you know very well, is that really isn't the intent of the interpretive guidelines. There needs to be a conversation. At the very least, as you were saying, making sure that the governing body is comfortable that the, you know, the peer review process, the credentialing process was done properly, and to throw it into a consent agenda, I feel actually bypasses the interpretive guidelines on that area.
Yeah, that Mary, well, I haven't read those interpretive guidelines recently, but just from a you know, corporate counsel standpoint, yeah, you really need the board to be integrated and involved, and surgery centers, they usually are. I mean, you know, the
They're
surgery center environment isn't one where typically your board is asleep at the wheel or something like that, or not paying attention, because they're usually the people that are the leaders. I do think it may vary depending on whether it's a JV and depending on the hospital
involved,
or a management company. You know, you know, that's one of the dangers of a you know, third party manager, is you start to think, you know, well, they're managing, and so you really got to remind your board members of what their duties are, and that you know, those still apply even if you've got a management company, and really, yeah, like you said, just trying to avoid the use of the consent agenda. I mean, the companies are not, you know, your 20 hospital health systems that where you need a consent agenda to get through meetings. These are usually smaller businesses, smaller enterprises, that there's really no reason to have a really substantial consent agenda.
Well, and my argument would be, if you're running that board meeting well, and we do a very good job of it, that board meeting is only an hour long anyway, you do a consent agenda, the meeting's only 10 minutes long, which the doctors might like, but I, as a surveyor, have a real problem with that.
Yeah. It gives me heartache as a lawyer too, because, you know, that's where the plaintiffs are looking first.
Yeah.
Even whether it's a commercial litigation claim or a med mal claim, I mean, you can really identify, if you're a clever plaintiff's attorney, some novel theories, depending on the involvement of your board.
Well, and let's talk about that just for a second too, is that you mentioned board education. That's one of our challenges right now, is that so many of our board, you know, they don't have the time. I get it. You know, they're doctors. They've, you know, every minute that they're in, not only the credentialing meeting, but the governing body meeting is, you know, they probably come up with a number, but they're losing money for every minute that they're in there, and they want these things over with very quickly. And to that end, they don't always know the rules. They're not reading the interpretive guidelines or the, you know, the conditions for coverage. They're certainly not reading the accreditation standards. Now, you don't know this, but as a podcast, we've introduced the governing body episodes. So there's actually focused episodes. There's only one right now, but it's one of those things we're working on.
I'll have to track that down.
Yeah, absolutely. But our goal is to try to give a 20-minute, we try to keep it to 20 minutes. Good luck with me talking. 20-minute, conversation about a very specific topic that's important to them. And I think this is one, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking to myself, this is a perfect thing to talk about. And I think, I hate to say it this way. Sometimes we just have to scare people by giving them, what the horror stories are out there. And you want to avoid that. None of us ever want to be in court because, again, talk about losing time in a board meeting, good luck spending all your time and not only that, but paying a lawyer, while you're having those conversations.
Right.
And you need to avoid that as much as possible. But I do think as an industry, we don't do a great job of getting board members to conferences like this, to educational programs like we put on or listening to podcasts. And there's certainly no books out there that they want to read. I do have a book out there about it, but I know not many people read it since it's not at the Amazon top of the list there. But I think one thing our listeners need to take away from this is that this conversation that they need to have after they listen to this podcast is not just with the credentialing committee, but with the governing body. You've got some incredible tools out there. The National Practitioner Data Bank report, that the application itself, where they outline all of the legal cases that they've had. Those are things that you need to spend some time looking at instead of just, instead of during the board meeting, somebody just saying, hey, Dr. Smith is up for privileges. Any objections to giving them those privileges? Right. That's not the way this should work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a risk. Working in nonprofit health system arena too, I mean, that is something where, those clients are used to that type of training because you got community members or
it's probably a requirement. People,
on the board. And so it's a different animal in a lot of respects. And my clients are all over the place. I have clients that, make me come, twice a year and do compliance training, not just to the board, but to the entire membership.
Yeah.
And that's great, and history tells me, anecdotal, but still 30 years worth of experience tells me that, those clients that are engaged in that, sort of prophylactic approach to training, whether it be just the board members or all of their physician investors have fewer disputes, have fewer issues that arise. So, I mean, it really is an investment of, are you going to pay less on the training and educational end, or are you going to roll the dice and see, hey, let's see what the claims look like. Not that anybody is consciously making that decision because nobody's that reckless or naive, but I think it's just not appreciating the investment and not appreciating the risk. So going back to what you're saying, maybe a horror story or scaring them to death works. And when I do those board trainings, I usually include one or two of those.
Otherwise, they fall asleep or spend most of their time looking at their cell phones.
It's sort of like, I think you and I are about the same age. So it's sort of back when we were in school, they'd make you watch those Scared Straight videos.
Yeah,
they worked.
Yeah, that was right. Eric, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much. I think you'd covered a topic that we need to spend some more time looking at, and I appreciate your time.
Oh, glad to do it, John. It's been great.
Thanks. Thank you.
In this segment, we provide an update on upcoming topics for the podcast, our upcoming virtual conferences, and upcoming speaking engagements for John and his staff and other events in the ASC industry.
The Georgia Society of ASCs and the South Carolina ASC Association's joint semiannual conference and trade show is going to be August 15th through the 16th in one of our favorite places, Sue Hilton Head, South Carolina, at the Marriott Hilton Head Resort and Spa. And I guess I just will reach out and mention to those people that we would love to speak there. So.
The Florida Society of Ambulatory Surgical Centers Quality and Risk Management Conference is April 4th and 5th, 2024 in Daytona Beach, Florida at the Hilton Oceanfront Resort. And their annual conference and trade show is July 17th through the 19th in Orlando, Florida, at the Signia by Hilton Orlando Bonnet Creek.
And ASCA 2024 will be at the Gaylord Palms Resort and Convention Center in Orlando, Florida. That's going to be April 17th through the 20th, 2024. And Sue, I believe you got everybody all signed up. I know it's been a pretty hefty check that we we wrote there for that. But we're definitely looking forward to that. And I'll be doing two sessions there. I'm going to be moderating one. I'm going to be doing a speech on how to do financial projections, kind of a brand new approach.
And the Arizona Ambulatory Surgery Center Association's conference is April 27th and 28th in Scottsdale, Arizona at the Westin Caroland Resort.
Gulf States Conference is going to be June 11th through the 13th in Biloxi, Mississippi at the Beau Rivage Resort and Casino.
Becker's Spine Orthopedic and Pain Management Driven ASC Conference is June 19th through the 22nd in Chicago at the Swiss Hotel.
The Texas Ambulatory Surgery Center Association's annual conference is July 24th through the 26th in Galveston, Texas at the San Luis Resort, Spa, and Conference Center.
The California Ambulatory Surgery Association's annual conference is September 4th through the 6th in Anaheim, California at the Anaheim Marriott.
The Tennessee Ambulatory Surgery Center Association's annual conference is September 12th through the 13th. In Chattanooga, Tennessee, at the Chattanoogan.
And Becker's ASC 30th Annual Meeting, the Business and Operations of ASCs, is October 30th through November 2nd in Chicago, Illinois, at the Hyatt Regency.
And don't forget about our second ever Business Office Manager Boot Camp, which will be March 12th through the 15th, 2024. And information about that is available on ASCCentral.com. And don't forget about on-demand versions of our various boot camps, including the ASC Director of Nursing, the ASC Administrators Boot Camp, and, of course, the Business Office Managers Boot Camp. And they're available at ASCCentral.com. Don't forget, we also have a lot of on-demand versions of various conferences over the year at the multi-state conference, for example. Is one of them that was presented in June of 2023. There's two whole days. It mirrored kind of a conference that you would have gone to, except that you didn't have to spend a lot of money for travel. And during that conference, we talked about infection control, life safety, survey preparation, human resources, an introduction to the Medicare ASC payment system, talked about pharmacy and staff retention. And again, we're going to be doing a new one this year. It's also going to be in June 2024. So more information to follow. And of course, please don't forget to become a patron member of the podcast, as we talked about earlier. For more information, visit us at asc-central.com. Patron membership helps defray the costs of producing the podcast, including our research staff, travel costs to conferences, equipment costs, and production costs. For more information, as I said, visit asc-central.com.
And thank you for joining us for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. If you found this episode informative, we encourage you to share it with your friends and colleagues in the ASC industry. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode. We would love any feedback about our episode or ideas for future episodes. Please send us an email at comments@ascpodcast.com.
We'd like to give a special thank you to our great team here at the podcast who make this possible. Our sound editor, Susan Cronkite, our executive producer, John Gailey, and our dedicated research team that includes Sue Cronkite, Jenna Alvarez, Judy D'Ambrosio, Mike D'Ambrosio, Alex Borneman, Zach Kalaritis, Jim Masters, Amy Cronkite, Lori Rodericks, Kathy Fodi, Donna Macchio, Christina Norman, and Katie Pearson. We couldn't do it without them. Our music is provided by Media Sushi and Mike Noah, and the ASC Podcast with John Gailey is hosted on Podbean and is available on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening. This episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey is sponsored by Surgical Information Systems, providing cutting-edge information solutions for surgery providers. Trivalence, offering a comprehensive and next-generation ASC solution that optimizes payment and supply chain performance, enabling actionable data insights. MedServe, which offers the only digital narcotic cabinet specifically designed and priced for surgery centers, helping standardize processes and compliance, eliminate paper logs, and prevent drug diversion. And Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, which is the nation's leading regulatory and accreditation compliance resource for ambulatory surgery centers. For information about any of our sponsors, please visit our website at ascpodcast.com.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development. All rights are reserved. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. And we'd love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.